Hello and welcome to Sangoma. Hello and welcome to Sangoma, stories from the front lines of mediation. My name is Bakabi Levantombini. I am a negotiation coach and couples mediator, and I'm so glad that you have decided to join the show today. We are going to be talking, Marty Epstein, my guest, and I are going to be talking about mediating deeper connections. So we hope that you will get a great benefit out of listening to Marty's story, and this is what we are about on the show. We are about people's stories. I'm about to bring Marty onto the show, and please welcome him. Hello, Marty. You're on.
Hi. This is an honor to be here, and it's kind of exciting to think that we're going over all those, in all those homes and places. It's amazing.
It is. It is amazing, isn't it? And this is something that can be heard all over the world. I know that there are folks who listen in South Africa. I've heard from folks in Germany. So from across the globe, there are people who will be able to tune into this show. So, yes, Marty, it's really, really exciting.
Oh, goodness.
And my, how times change. I remember when I first met you, you were a student of mine at Columbia.
Yes. Yes, you were our ombuds teacher. I never even knew what the word meant until you told us about it.
Right. And you were in my first class, so you're somebody that I remember quite well. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience to have you in class, and it's now a wonderful experience to have you as a guest on our show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Well, you know, the show is about mediators telling their stories, and you have quite a story yourself. I'm curious about how mediators come to decide to take up the field of mediation, what inspires them to do it to begin with, to take up the profession, and then what inspires them to keep going. What I understand about your background, Marty, if we could go back to sort of the beginning of things, is that you were raised here in New York City and that you got an early understanding of the importance of communication. It sounds like you lived in a rather quiet household, so it wasn't about having a lot of communication in your house. It was actually kind of the opposite.
Exactly. I'm not sure if it was quiet. My mother, when she wanted something, tended to scream more than speak. And my father was rather quiet, and there was really no communication other than orders or information that was given. So we would never, I mean, I didn't know what it was like to sit down and talk about what was going on in my day or to have any real interest. It was kind of new to know, once I went to school, to know that those kinds of conversations took place. So it was an we didn't have that really in my household. I mean, my parents cared and loved me, and my sister. However, they just I don't know. It was just something that was not part of their life. And I just remember as a student in elementary school, just listening, really learning how to have a conversation. What do you do? So it was like this blank slate going out and just trying to understand what was going on in the world. And I learned conversation through listening, mimicking, and then eventually it became my own.
It's an amazing thing you're saying, Marty. On the one hand, there's a part of me that feels kind of sad, you know, that in your home, it wasn't a place where you felt that you had an opportunity to converse and so forth and share. So I guess there's a sort of an expectation, a norm of how families communicate. And on the one hand, you know, families are different, and it's great to be open and warm and welcoming to all different ways that families communicate or sometimes don't communicate. But it sounds, on the other hand, to be kind of lonely.
In ways it was, and you know, as a child you begin to adjust. And where my focus started moving as a young child was to my friends and to the world, so that I eventually learned how to get that quality of connection through the world, through my interactions with people. And fortunately, my father's skills rubbed off on me, and I learned how to be find ways that I can move and develop friendships with ease. So it was easy for me to create friendships and be with people and in a way that they felt comfortable and I felt comfortable. So a sense of humor was there, and a sharpness of learning how not to, rather than move towards conflict, I learned very much how to stay in balance. And I'm not sure if my Libra, sign is also participating in that as well. But that's I found ways of compensating, and it actually it worked out for me through those years. I found ways of getting what I was missing in my home life.
Well, your resilience and ingenuity and resourcefulness are really amazing. I think as well that while there's a part of me, again, that feels at least ambivalent about this, on the other hand, I'm thinking, wow, what an opportunity to learn how to communicate. I think a lot of us may come from homes where there was a lot of communication going on, and so it's sort of second nature, and we didn't have a chance early on to sort of step back and analyze what's going on and figure things out. Do you remember from your childhood what your observations were and what really informed your learning process about how to communicate?
Actually, yeah. And just as a side note, I do give workshops and work with people in many different ways. And when I tell my story to them, a good percentage of people acknowledge that they've come from similar backgrounds. So the sense of camaraderie and companionship, I'm not alone. It's amazing, and there is there's almost a sense of bonding and connection with participants in my groups. So, and we may get to that later. But in answer to your question, I learned very young that when I would tell my day to my mother, and she seemed to be distracted, and I learned very quickly that when she wasn't present, I stopped talking. So I do not. So when I'm with people, and I sense that they're distracted, I would stop and reconnect with them, because I learned that anything that I say once they're not there, or if I sense that they're not there and they tell me that they're not there, there's no connection anymore. So I learned very young in life how important it was to stay connected.
So it's a matter of you staying connected, but then also making sure that the other person is connecting with you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I didn't have those skills early in life. What I tended to do was I just stopped talking, and then I just waited. Yeah.
So a lot of us would just sort of charge through. I mean, we've been in situations where the other person's maybe checking their phone or, you know, is otherwise distracted, and we might keep on talking. What you would do in that situation, you're saying, is that you basically just stop.
I would stop and just wait when they finished, and then and then just continue once I sensed that there was a connection there. If in business meetings, when someone would start writing notes and doing responding to emails while I'd be giving my report or just checking in with a manager, I would stop and I would just say, you know, it sounds like this is important to you. Why don't you finish that? And I'd like to, then I can continue. And that to me seemed to me more effective than just talking. You know, he says, well, I can hear, you know, I can hear and type. And I said, I'm sure you can. And I would really like us to have a one-to-one on this.
Wow. What were people's reactions?
I, you know, there was a bit of fluster, and it seemed to work. I know it worked for me, because it was very hard for me to stay connected if I, you know, as they were typing on their, you know, typing their emails or responding to a text or something. It just, I lose my sense of self-connection when I feel that. So I wait. And, you know, I mean, this isn't like 100%, but generally in life, this is what I do. If,
you know,
I was just going to say that when people talk, sometimes they talk over or they want to trump what you're saying. I would pause and let them say what they have to say, and then I would see if it's an opportunity to continue.
Wow. First of all, that seems to require a great deal of patience, you know, to allow the person to go on and then come in. I can see conversations on the one hand taking a little bit longer, perhaps at the beginning, but then perhaps the other person catches on and you end up having a more effective conversation. And I say this too because it's something that we teach folks in communication, and they have to come in and take classes and, you know, pay to learn this, and this is something that you figured out on your own.
Yes, and it's interesting that you say that, Patabli, because the name of my business is Effective Conversation. You know, the thing is that if there is a disconnect, then what's the reason to continue conversation if no one is listening, or one person is listening and the other one is just talking? I mean, it's so ineffective, and especially if you're in business where time is valuable. Yes, take the time for them, you know, if you're going to need to finish an email or a text, finish it. Because, I mean, if I'm going to be speaking to you and giving you information or reporting and you're not there, I mean, what use, you know?
Right.
So it may appear to be longer, and yet in the long run, at least there's an opportunity. I mean, who knows what people hear or don't hear. I know that for me, I need that focus.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And having the self-confidence and the sense of self to be able to request that is really important. I really like the fact that, you know, sometimes things that are blessings or, you know, things that turn out to be real assets come out of a certain place of lack, I guess. One might consider it to be a place of lack, and yet it turns out to be this really wonderful thing. You know, you said that when somebody is no longer connecting with you, when they're not listening with you, you know, this is something that happened in your relationship with your mother, that you cannot continue talking. And while another person might see it as a thing of strength to be able to continue and to maintain your focus, and in spite of the fact that this other person is not paying attention to you, what it has turned out to be, I think, you know, your need for connection has turned out to be an asset, a terrific asset.
It's true, and with that understanding, Patabli, I'm learning that who am I to judge what is a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, what may appear in my experience or in my life as bad may not be that. Who knows? I mean, and what's becoming clear is that all I can speak about is what's going on for me. To judge someone as having a bad experience, I don't know. I mean, and actually, I don't even know if people are connected with me or not. All I can go is with what's true for me in the moment. And if it seems true, I check reality, you know, like, you know, if someone is texting, I would just say, it appears that this is important. I'm going to just pause for a moment until you finish that. And they could very well be, you know, they say that they may be able to be connected with me, and that's fine. But for me, it just doesn't work. And if they have difficulty with it, what better way to connect with someone when, you know, when someone is upset? I mean, they're telling you really where it's at. Another way of connecting, building relationship. I mean, the whole thing is good as far as I see it.
Well, this is excellent. And I want to make sure that people are able to reach you. You mentioned the name of your business and what it is that you do. So if you could briefly mention that, and we'll come back into the conversation, and then later on we'll talk more about how you've developed your practice. But what, again, is the name of your practice?
It's Effective Conversation. My website is effectiveconversation.com. Effective Conversation is one word, .com. And I can be reached by Marty at effectiveconversation.com if
okay.
People wish to. Thank you.
Right, and we will repeat that information again later on in the show. But, you know, coming back to what you developed out of the necessities that you had to have the full attention of the person that you're speaking to and to give full attention to the person that you're speaking to, and this resulting in you having more effective communications. You know, you're not speaking with somebody who's distracted. You're actually maintaining that connection. I'd love to talk a little bit more about connection and what that means for you when it comes to communicating with people. I think that we have a lot of surface conversations with folks, and we're not really aware of, you know, having intentional conversations or connected conversations. So what does that mean for you?
Well, you know, what is a meaningful or deep or a conversation? I mean, those are just terms. What I can go by is how I feel as I'm speaking with someone. And so if I'm finding that my mind is wandering or I'm distracted, it's important for me to bring myself back and to connect with the person. And I may say, you know, like, you know, I'm hearing your words, and right now I'm just finding myself kind of like, you know, like a bit distracted, so I'd really want to connect with you. So this is what I'm hearing so far, and tell me if this is, you know, if we're in line. So I'm trying continually to stay as present as I can, and that, you know, and I do find myself wandering, and when I do, I bring myself back and acknowledge that when I can. You know, at times I just don't, or I'm, you know, at times when I was with my boss, when I was in corporate America, I would kind of like pretend, you know, and do one of those nods where, you know, you're saying yes and you have no idea what was just said. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. I may just be...
Well, you are, and you've actually provided me a wonderful segue, because I wanted to talk about what you discovered when you were in corporate America and then what you were able to implement based on what you observed when you were being managed by other people. So you have been talking about, you know, being very present or trying to be present in a conversation. And then what I'm hearing you say is that you're also very transparent in your conversations if you feel that you're not remaining present, if your attention is wandering. You know, you let a person know that is happening for yourself. But it also sounds like you're saying that when you were in corporate America, that's something that was not exactly available for you to do.
It was difficult. There's a whole hierarchy and wanting to be, you know, going through wanting to appear to be knowledgeable. I mean, if you know something and you have information and you know how to do something, then, you know, I interpreted that as having value, and therefore that will keep my job, you know. So being in IT, in information technology, in the latter years I was a manager. So going into meetings, it was important to appear, you know, that you know what's going on with your teams. You know how teams are functioning, if there's any problems. And at times I found that I didn't have all the information, and that was very troubling. It was very stressful. So being uncomfortable, you know, through the source of feeling pain, I realized that I wasn't getting the information that I wanted from my team. And so what was wrong here? Why didn't I know? And one of the areas that I found myself looking is, rather than blaming them, what is it that I'm not doing? You know, so I'm continually coming back to how can I refine my work, my understanding, my connection with my team to understand. So we started having meetings, and I learned very quickly that it wasn't what I had to say, it's allowing them to speak and allowing them to have the freedom to speak and be open rather than judging or saying what they didn't do, to acknowledge what was done and to be able to work with them if there were any problems. So what was coming up was more and more trust. I was getting better information, and there was a sense of ease. You know, that doesn't mean that we didn't get the job done when we needed to get it done. There was a way of holding the team, myself, and the group, and that they can speak about what was going on. So it's an openness, and I found that to be so helpful. And the team, really enjoyed working as a team and working with me and I with them, because there was no need to hide, no need to feel that you had to know everything. Let's just say what's there.
Well, I know that that must not have been a common experience for the people who are in your team, and that from the at the beginning, anyway, it wouldn't be what they expected. What were you hearing from your team as you were requesting them to be transparent and open and give you feedback?
Well, you know, it wasn't, I couldn't request that. What I did was I modeled it myself. And when I had uncertainty, I acknowledged I had uncertainty. When I felt that I didn't know something, I came to them, and if there were questions, I would ask. It would be a way of just showing that my job is to oversee and to provide guidance where I could, and to get you to help you do your job. So as I kept on helping by making their job easier, more and more trust. So it's a matter of trust. I mean, to tell someone, well, I want you to be transparent, you know, that doesn't work. It never worked for me. I mean, okay, let's be open. You know, how do you, you know, what does that mean to be open? You know, I'll tell you what you want to hear. That's open, right? Isn't it?
Wow.
So it's modeling it. You know, it's living that. And then I think what had happened was people found more, they were able to relax more, because I wasn't, when we had our reviews, it wasn't judging them. It's let's take a look at what's here and asking them where they found areas that they would like to work on, and how can I support you? How can I be? So as a manager, my job is to support the team, to get to help them do the best job that they can.
Well, how long did it take the team? And this is wonderful. This is amazing. But how long did it take the team to actually trust you, that you weren't, you know, opening a door for them to fall through?
Let's see. I'm thinking about an experience that I had when I was at Charles Schwab on the West Coast. And I came in as a senior manager. And this team had a number of different managers. And it was an investment bank, and they can be a fierce place. It's a lot of competition and a lot of CYA activity going on. I would say 3 months, and that's just a guess. It was just a guess. However, we had weekly meetings. I would with the team, and then I would have one-on-one with the team, with the group, with individuals, and it's hard to say in time, but if I were to throw a number at it, I would say 3 months of just allowing them to speak and be open to what they had to say was very important, in, that I found from with this group.
So it sounds like, you know, being consistent about it, really modeling it. 3 months is really not that long.
No, I mean, we had some ways to go, but I think that the level of trust and ease when we were together and the openness in our meetings, that is what I value, and that's what, and the team was moving in that direction.
That's wonderful. I keep thinking, how come all managers can't be like that? I'm curious about what you got as feedback from other managers. Were they aware of how you were leading your team and the impact that it had?
Well, and the people that I found myself associating with at Schwab and then eventually at another company in New York, we were of like mind. That's why they hired me, actually, because they were looking for people who would be able to model that. And then with my nonviolent communication experience, they were looking. They kept on asking me questions on how they can bring that into their team. So it was. In this corporation, I was more of a magnet, you know, where people would want to know more about that. In fact, they were so interested. They asked me to bring nonviolent communication into the corporation, and I, in fact, did that with a group, and we had some workshops, and then eventually I would have weekly brown bags, which was very effective.
That is simply amazing, because as you said, investment banking can be a rather prickly place, if I can put it that way, and to hear that a company was that interested in doing things differently is really encouraging. You've mentioned nonviolent communication, and I want to get into that in just a moment, but I also wanted to ask you about how you came into this way of leadership. I mean, it's one thing to be very aware of your own need for connection when you're in conversation, waiting until a person is in a place where they can fully pay attention to you and so forth. Leadership requires a skill set that, for me, is a little bit more complicated. I mean, there's a great deal of temptation, I suppose, to take on the role of somebody who's all-knowing. I mean, you're the leader. You're supposed to know everything. There's this sense of hierarchy, and so the people who report to you are your subordinates. You know, there's a lot of ego involved, and it sounds as though that wasn't ever really an issue for you. Did you ever struggle with that, and how did you come to develop a place where the temptations to fall into the ego of leadership becomes difficult?
Oh, Jesus, yeah. I had all of that when I started. One, as an employee, you know, I was on a staff position. I started off as a programmer, and then as I moved to senior programmer analyst, and had some people reporting to me there. And it was, and I saw very early in that what a painful place to be, to think that I know everything. I learned programming, you know, just by doing it. So I didn't have any formal training. This was in the early 80s when we had green screens and just moving from cards to the keyboard. And I just picked up as I went along, and I just happened to do well at that. So they moved me to a senior position, and I thought I was supposed to know everything, and I didn't. I didn't know. I mean, I don't know what I knew, but it really wasn't everything at all or anything. You know, I wasn't sure I knew anything. So to appear to be that way was so painful. And at some point, I just had I was just so nervous and so anxious that I had to release and move into a place where I just had to acknowledge I didn't know. So, I mean, I've learned, the management style that I came to was out of my, you know, just out of necessity. You know, it wasn't that I meant to do anything. It just, for me, it was easier to be authentic and open than to be, you know, to pretend to be someone that I wasn't. And it was just out of survival.
I have to say that, you know, you're stating it in terms of, well, it was just survival, but even coming to a place of awareness where one listens to oneself to that deep level and says, you know, I have to relinquish this for the sake of my own survival, for me that seems to be a brave thing to do. You know, there are these things that we hang on to that are inculcated, I suppose, culturally, that, you know, this is what a strong person looks like and this is how you maintain strength. And to let go of that, it requires its own kind of strength. So, you know, I have to acknowledge and commend you for being able to care for yourself in that way. You've mentioned nonviolent communication, and I'm curious about the time period in which you came to know of nonviolent communication and begin practicing it. It sounds as though you were doing a lot of this before you even encountered the practice.
You know, I never thought of it that way, Patable, but I think you were right. You know, it was just, there's always was a longing to connect with people, deeper, and I don't know if deeper is the word, but something that was more more meaningful to me. Yes, I had the conversations about, you know, oh, you know, that guy and that guy, and, you know, just very kind of like about people and gossipy, but I never found myself gravitating towards that. I really wanted to understand what was going on with other people, because I just was so confused about myself, you know. So I thought by listening and hearing what other people's experience was, maybe I could learn something, because I was just so confused in my late teen, well, most of my life. I was, you know, what's going on here? I don't understand my emotions and what was happening in the world. So I thought that by speaking with other people, well, I learned how to converse, maybe I could learn about my emotional life, you know. So it was just a way. So although you're expressing appreciation about that, for me, I had no choice, because this is what I needed to do to understand.
Right. I think one of the reasons why I'm, you know, commending you and acknowledging you is because it's something that I'm not really good at doing myself.
Mm.
And you're making me think about that, about, you know, allowing myself to take care of myself in a way that might end up being of benefit in many other ways, but that, you know, it's okay for me to sort of put myself first and to actually consider my needs and do self-care. And that by doing self-care, I'm actually benefiting other people. It's not a negative, selfish act.
That's exactly right. That's what I'm coming to see, is that by caring for ourselves, I mean, if you're in place, if you're self-connected, I mean, then whomever you're in touch with will then have someone present. I mean, isn't that what we want? When we speak, don't we want someone to listen? And when someone speaks to us, don't we want to hear the truth? I mean, everything else is just pain. You know, it hurts. You know, and I don't mean like you stick a needle, but just watching inside, there's a closing, a contraction. And what I've come to see is that life can be a delight when I'm feeling this sense of self-connection and I'm open. And when I'm closed, it hurts.
Right. Oh, and it's so simple when you put it that way.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, if it's complicated, I think we're adding stuff. We're making it complicated, because it really is so simple. I mean, we know when we're uncomfortable, and it's that's when we can start listening.
Right. And, you know, though, I have to say that maybe it might be a gender thing, although I don't want to stereotype it too much, but, you know, girls are taught to be caretakers, at least stereotypically, and so forth, and to put their own needs aside. And so I'm wondering whether that might be it as well, that one learns to ignore pain. Oh, but men, too. You know, there's a certain kind of stoicism that is expected, and boys are taught, you know, boys don't cry. And it can be interpreted that boys don't feel pain. So even the ability to be aware that, oh, I'm in pain, I'm contracting, is something that I think folks have to learn, because it has been drummed out of them, you know, from the very beginning.
You're right that we have to reconnect. We have to really it's time to listen. I mean, we're all running from one thing to the next to have an experience. I mean, how many places can I visit? How much money can I have? If I have the money, then I'll get what I want. Why don't you just cut out the money and get what you, because you can get what you really want is happiness anyhow. What you want is connection. You want relationship. And we tend to go to do the things rather than just stopping and seeing that we have it all right now. It's
That's
so
right.
available.
Right.
It's
right,
it's amazing.
You know, I want to take you back for a moment, because this revelation that you're sharing with us, which really ought not to be a revelation, it's something that we, I think, always know, but don't always pay attention to. It's something that you have been developing over time, and you mentioned earlier in the conversation, and I talked a bit about your influences, your early influences, and you said you learned a lot from your dad as well. Tell me a bit more about that.
Well, my dad, he worked very hard, and we could never really have a conversation. However, there was a couple of things that he has said to me that has been, for me, very important. One is that your word is your bond. So for me, when I make a commitment, I hold it. I hold it pretty tight. So I appreciate that. That has meant a lot. And he was always, my sister reminded me this the other day. She said, you know, Dad used to say, you know, have a kind word. It doesn't cost you anything. And he was always a lighthearted man, a good-natured man. So that's what he has given me. And there's an ease that people enjoyed being with him. He was a friendly, jovial fellow. And so that's his gift to me.
Right. So through your dad, you have it sounds like kindness really coming through. A place in which you're centered around being able to acknowledge other people and be kind. You know, as you said, say a kind word. It doesn't cost you anything. It's okay to go a little bit of an extra step to make people feel good.
Yeah, and it isn't to make them feel good. I'm not sure if that's what it is. What I'd like to do is when I see. Yeah, it's acknowledging. You know, it's really the ease, and I love to acknowledge, because when I'm acknowledging something that I see that pleases me, I'm acknowledging myself, because I'm feeling good, and hey, you know, that I'm just acknowledging what I'm enjoying. So it's actually it's a gift to myself.
And again, it's an amazing thing that by giving a gift to yourself, it's not a negative selfishness, but that it allows others to experience that pleasure as well. And when we're talking about making people feel good, you're absolutely right, because as soon as the words came out of my mouth, I thought about you know, what I tell people about owning their emotions and also being cognizant of what they're responsible for regarding other people. So one cannot make another person feel good, but you can, you know, create a space in which the other person can enjoy the acknowledgement of whatever it is that they've done.
And that's what we're talking about. By you holding the space, by you being connected to yourself and you being open, that allows them the space to move in whatever works for them. It's you, really, you know, and it isn't the you in a small you. It's by you being in self-connected, knowing who you are in that moment, whatever it could be. I mean, it could be anything going on, and being able to acknowledge it and be open with it allows others to have that space. And therefore, there's the freedom for people to be themselves as you are yourself. And who isn't attracted to that?
Truly, truly, yeah. But you're bringing some things that can bring us back forward to a place where you discover nonviolent communication. Because talking about holding a space, my understanding, and it's not really that vast, my understanding of nonviolent communication, but one of the things that I do understand is that creating a space in which certain kinds of conversations can happen is part of NVC. So tell me a bit about how you came to encounter NVC and what it's all about.
This is interesting. My wife and I moved upstate after 9/11. We have a summer house there, and we thought this would be a time for us to, rather than commuting upstate, we would now live upstate, and then we would hold our apartment in the city, and we'll see what happens. So I moved upstate, and a friend of mine had given me a book called Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life. And I don't usually read books that people give me. I'm just, you know, although I'm curious about things, I just, for some reason, I just don't read books. But this one I read, and it seemed to strike every chord in my, that felt right for me. And it's Marshall Rosenberg who wrote the book. And shortly after I finished the book, my wife and I went down to Florida to visit my parents. And I'm not sure about the audience, but usually within 30 seconds of walking into the door, I'm triggered usually by my mother. She would say something like, "What? You didn't take off your shoes? How could you come in?" And I haven't seen her for months, right? So I would just, like, usually that would end the conversation, and I would usually be quiet after that. But after the book, there was just something that I was able to connect with. What was it that, what needs were not being met? Because it's... nonviolent communication is about needs and centering on what it is that everything that we're doing is based on needs. So that much I got. And in connecting with that in myself and then connecting in the needs of my mother, something shifted. And so rather than 30 seconds and being closed off to my family, I found that I was able to stay connected at least another day and a half.
That's
remarkable. That was remarkable. I said, there's something to this thing, and I just continued studying. Yeah.
Sorry, it works. I chuckled when you talked about, you know, coming to the door and your mom meeting you and asking these questions that eventually, you know, within 30 seconds had you triggered. That brought me to thinking of, you know, Seinfeld and George Costanza and his relationship with his mother, and how, you know, having that relationship on that show was a sort of emblematic of something that a lot of people could relate to. Now, when you have read the book and you have your nonviolent communication as a tool to use, when you arrive at the door and your mom is, you didn't take off your shoes and all that sort of thing, you know, what goes through your mind in terms of connecting with her needs? You're now thinking from a needs perspective, so what goes on?
It depends on what's being said. One is I'm in touch with my needs, which is connection with my mother. The need to be warm and loving comes up for me, so I'm in touch with that. And then she may say something like, you know, what do you, you know, what's going on? You know, you just walked in without your, you know, you take off your shoes. And I would notice that there would be, my heart would probably do a flip in a moment, or my stomach would clench, and I would just check in and just say, ah, oh, you know, you're really wanting to connect, and that need is not being met. What could be going on here? And I would really immediately go, because I've worked with this enough, is that my mother really values order and cleanliness. And she has that as a higher priority than connection. That is so important for her. And I get that. And with that understanding, I can relax more. And knowing what this is, and I would try to support her. You know, yes, Ma, I understand, and I'll take off my shoes. And when she can relax around that, then she could move to other emotions and other places.
So recognizing that the way that a person might approach you to begin with can be a signal of what's really important to them, what is a true need for them, and if that need is not addressed, then it can be very difficult to move on to something else.
It could be, and what I've learned is to listen, and you know, and you never know what's going on for anyone else. So I would want to, you know, just say, you know, it's really important, Ma, that the floor be kept clean, and that you really want the everything to be in, you know, in order. Is that, you know, is that what's going on? She said, yeah, you know, I worked hard to make this house, you know, the floor, you know, the room in order so you can come and appreciate it. So as we begin to do that, and we don't even have that level of conversation, but it would be some tidbits of it, I would see that what she's doing is, this is her way of expressing love to me, by having the place in order.
Clean, right.
So I mean, how can I not... I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, how could you not fall in love with that? How could you not love, you know, how could you not, you know, so where it could be something that would be, oh, she cares more about the floor than me, I've learned to see that she cares about the floor because she cares about me, and this is the way she expresses it.
And wow. And it allows you then a chance or an opportunity to empathize with her, and then to express your empathy to her in a way that lets her connect with you.
Exactly. That's it. So it's allowing her the space to be, and through that, I can connect and connect in my own heart with her, and then there's, you know, we're together.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we want? Yeah.
Right, yeah, I'm really feeling this floor thing.
You're feeling what?
The idea, the floor, you know, the idea of the clean floor, and just the mind shift that occurs, because when you started telling the story, I think a lot of people could sympathize with, you know, arriving at the door, you haven't seen your mom in a long time, or whichever parent it is, and you walk into a barrage of criticism.
Yes.
You know, and it feels like an attack, and it can feel like you know, you're lacking in some way, and so forth, and you're just walking in the door. What you presented allows for a tremendous mind shift that says, wait a minute, let me appreciate what is going on for this other person, and actually see it as, you know, maintaining a clean home is how Mom shows love for me.
Yeah, and it isn't like, it isn't an airy fairy kind of thing, Patakli. It's really seeing that as I'm listening and really connecting with her, that this is the way it's expressed. It isn't. I'm not trying to overlay it with goody goody. I mean, this is what I see is true. And I could be, who knows? I mean, the whole thing is, everything is our interpretation anyhow. You know, the way we see it. And this is what I'm seeing, and for me, this is true. Better than the other story.
I'm
the other story, it hurts.
Pardon?
The other story hurts.
Yes, right. The first story, the second story,
yeah,
really good.
Isn't it nice? I mean, that's
it is.
What a way to go through life that way, right?
And it's amazing that you have that caveat saying, you know, it isn't airy-fairy. I think you're speaking to something that I find to be unfortunate in that things that make people feel good and people having that sort of sunshine in their lives and so forth can be met with a certain amount of derision. I think that there's a certain value, a cultural value in suffering, you know, that we share in common.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly. I mean, if it doesn't hurt, it's not real. If you're in pain, you know, that's what reality is. If you're happy, then there's something wrong here. You're making, you know, you're living in a bubble, and you know, I would rather live in a bubble. I'm happy. You know why you know, I mean, think of all the times we've been in pain. I mean, is that how we want to go through life? I mean, why not? I mean, and I'm not saying make things up. I mean, but there. I mean, we're interpreting things in so many ways, and generally, it's negative. It hurts us, and we think that that's right, and we never ever question it. Ever.
Well, it's amazing what has happened in just the last few minutes. You're sharing the story and the, you know, just different perspectives and ways of approaching it. I know for myself it's really been eye-opening. I imagine that a person coming to your practice would have plenty of opportunities to experience this and really learn from it. Tell me more about your practice.
Well, I have a couple of empathy groups. We call them empathy groups, where we come together and just talk about whatever is going on in people's lives. And we've learned to listen and provide a space and where it, for clarity, we would guess what may be going on. And it's allowing each of us to just be ourselves and no advice, no sympathy. It's really just understanding, for each of us to understand where we can, and allowing the speaker, whoever may be up at the time, to speak what's going on for them. And by allowing that space and asking questions in terms of what guessing what may be what they may be needing, or just looking at something that that seems so painful and not exploring it, allowing them to look at it, it just allows people to begin to see that how we create our own pain, how we create the difficulties that that are in our lives. And we tend to blame others for what we're experiencing. And in truth, our experience is our experience and how we're interpreting it. So it's an opportunity for self-reflection. And that's my empathy groups tend to move in that direction. We work that way. I just had one last night, and the people just leave so changed. It's like, and they have a chance to work with it during the week. And
I really can believe that, because I know just in the course of this conversation, I've really been changed. You know, even though this is something that I've known for in my own practice, you know, I'm a trained mediator myself, but there's something about hearing it articulated in the way that you did that has opened things up a little bit more for me as well. So I can only imagine. Pardon?
What shifted for you? What changed?
Well, it really was about that story with your mom. I don't know if my mom was listening. My mom often listens to my shows. So we got to talk, Mom. but, you know, my mom is also a tremendous house manager. And I have had these situations where I've come in and, you know, maybe I'm visiting, and Mom's about to get to work. You know, let's clean this, or let's change that, or... You know, she's a very project-oriented and a tremendously successful person in that way. What's happening for me when I walk in the door is I want to put my bags down and say hi, and, you know, how have you been? And I want to relax and grab some juice or, you know, water or something and sit down. And, you know, mom's ready to go.
Yeah.
And so, you know, understanding from her perspective why that's important and how she has benefit for me in mind as well. It's not all just about her. You know, that has been an important shift for me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, to understand that what she's asking of you is a way that she's giving you gifts, and it may not appear that way to you, and yet she values, engagement. She values work. I mean, that means a lot to her. And
right.
What better gift than she can give you is what means so much to her. I mean, she's continually giving what matters. It's
right.
It's an act of love over and over.
Wow. I want to make sure that folks know how to contact you. So please give us that information again.
They could reach me at marty@effectiveconversation.com. That's my email. Should I give my phone number, my office number?
You could, but you also have your website.
Okay, it's on my website, so they can go there. And
right.
And my website is effectiveconversation.com.
Okay, that's fantastic. And I will provide links also on my own blog page, which is Sangoma at blogspot.com. So sangoma.blogspot.com. And so I'll make sure that information is available to folks too, and I'll have a sort of a write-up of the show that's available for people as well. I had a question. You know, we're coming down to the last couple of minutes of the show, so we're going to have to be sort of brief about this, but you mentioned no sympathy in your groups, and I was curious about what that meant.
Well, sympathy is really someone taking... hearing what someone says, then relating it to themselves, and then having their own reactions about what's going on. So what's going on now is we've lost connection with the person that we're with, and now it's becoming about us. Now, that's certainly fine, and yet if your intention is to be with someone, to walk with someone, to connect with someone, that has been lost in that moment.
Right. Okay. That's an amazing insight to have. I think a lot of us think that sympathizing with something or someone is a great thing.
And, you know, in this situation, it very well can be a great thing. And what I'm saying is that if you're wanting connection and you're really wanting to support someone else in what they may be experiencing, then I would move towards empathy, which would be understanding and being with that person. If something...
taking on.
Yeah, exactly. Because now it's about you, and you may need that. And, who am I to judge what that is? And know that when I'm crying... because someone is in, someone's talking about their childhood, and now I'm crying about my childhood. You know, where are we now?
Mm-hmm.
Are we together? You know, so now you have two people crying, and who's supporting whom?
Right. Well, amazing, Marty, and this has been a wonderful conversation. I thank you so much for coming on. I've learned something about. By having this conversation with you. Thank you so much.
And I really want to thank you. I mean, I'm looking through your website and all that you're doing to engage people and offer the world connection and story. And thank you so much for what you're doing. I mean, I just see your heart all over this webpage. I'm seeing these beautiful people.
It's my pleasure. It is my pleasure. Thank you so much. And I do want to correct something that I said. In terms of reaching the blog that is connected to the show, it's actually untangledresolutions@.blogspot.com. Untangledresolutions, one word, .blogspot.com. And you can go there for more information about the guests and about the information that you hear here on the show. So with a thanks to Marty, I'm going to be signing off now. Next week, join us to hear Tara Fischler, and she's going to be talking about mediating with our youngest mediators. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. We're going to leave you with a piece now called Remembrance by Vijay Iyer. He's one of my favorite musicians, and we heard a piece from him last week, and I'm going to do that again this week. I hope that you look him up, and we love to support independent musicians here on this show. Hope you come back again next week, and have a wonderful week. Talk to you later. Thank you.